So now we'll do the opposite breath. We will breathe in the left nostril and we'll breathe out the right nostril. And again, to the count of four, breathing in, left, two, three, out right, two, three, four, in left, out right, in left, out right, in left, out right, in left, out right. And observe. Now we'll do the same breath that we'll hold in between to the count of four. So in left, hold, out right, in left, hold, out right. In left, hold, out right, in left, hold, out right, and observe. Again, if there are those in the room that can share their observations, it's often helpful to articulate it and also to share it. Someone would like to say something.
Open, receptive, less blockage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the previous one brought light and kind of lifted the head and the upper, this one brought them down to interconnection and flow,
okay,
harmony.
Yeah. Your turn.
I observed a creative element.
Mm-hmm.
Art.
Anything else?
Aware of clearing internally here and more aware of things like a pulling up.
Okay. did people feel this was a more active or receptive breath? Could you discern?
This felt more active. The other previous one more receptive. They both feel energizing.
Yeah, well, just breathing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's so amazing. It's like, oh my God, it's the best medicine in the world. Why don't we think about this some more? Isn't it true? Part of it is just taking the time to sit. It doesn't take very long. We haven't worked at it very long, were we? Any other questions or any comments? Or comments or questions, I guess I should say. So you can see that alternating these nostrils can create a different effect. And it's, as I said, it's such a vast study. I mean, we could study to infinity and perhaps not exhaust all of the understanding and awareness. But you see, of course, these breaths also have planetary influences and elemental influences and energetic influences. And you see, that's what mysticism is seeing beyond this surface of things and understanding the nature of vibration. Now, Murshid elaborates here in another Gita, again on mysticism, and this one is titled Relating to Jalal. Jalal is again the principle that we would call the more active principle, or the principle that is perhaps identified with the masculine, powerful principle in the archetypal sense, you might say. The Jalal aspect shows the strength and power of nature. We can find Jalal power flowing through the right nostril as breath, working through the right hand, giving it an inclination to move first through the right foot, giving it an inclination to step first. In the senses, that which shows is Jalal. That which sees is Jamal. You understand? That which shows is Jalal. It's the active principle. That that sees, that that observes, is Jalal, the receptive principle. You see the difference? That which speaks is Jalal. That which hears is Jamal. You see the difference? So there's always an energetic giving out, and then the receiving of that. The same thing we find in our thought. The thought which rises of itself in the mind is the Jalal thought. The thought which is caused by some other source is the Jamal thought. So something stimulates then a line of thinking is Jamal. It's something that just arises energetically is Jalal. You understand? Does it make sense?
Energetically is Jalal or Jamal?
Jalal, masculine. You can think of it as the two verticals. It's a two pillars. And the Jamal is has the curves of the M, so it's feminine. You see if you have, it can help you remember those words. Does that make sense for those that aren't familiar with those terms?
So if you're breathing in the right nostril, you're stimulating your left mind, which is your powerful mind. And if you're
the analytical.
In the left nostril, you're stimulating your right mind, which is your more artistic.
Right. And this is very important because, you know, this has to do with sort of the neurology of the brain, and I'm glad you bring this up because certainly in the Eastern traditions, they do ritualistic prayer with light and bells that are stimulating the opposite parts of the brain, you know, and so they're doing this very purposefully, and I think that I've said this before, you all probably have heard it, but I will say it again, that these people that have done these rituals for such a long time, they have, some of them have incurred some sort of head injury, and they're finding that they don't have the severity of disability that others that have not participated in these rituals do, because the two hemispheres of the brain have been stimulated in a balanced way. So although these rituals have spiritual meanings, there's also very functional reasons for them as well. Every person has either a Jalal temperament or a Jamal temperament. A person with temper is Jalal. With courage is Jalal. With power, with strength is Jalal. A person with kindness, tolerance, forgiveness, meekness, mildness, modesty, humility is of a Jamal temperament. Then, through the day and night, man or woman changes his condition from Jalal to Jamal and from Jamal to Jalal, either owing to the influence of the breath or controlled by the breath of another. So here we can influence each other by our breaths. So if we are in a receptive mode, we are in our left nostril breathing, very receptive to other thoughts, to other people's breaths. You see this? It's such a subtle study. And if we're active, we can send out. You understand?
And if you don't want to be receptive to a situation, it's, you hold the left side, right?
Yes, you can breathe in and out the right. My teacher, Murshida Vira, who was known, she had a great capacity to understand the elements, and she was very much a healer in the... She was educated as a nurse and as an educator. And one of the things that she used to say, and anyone that has met her knows she was a little bit fiery. The apple hasn't fallen far from that tree, for both my mother and my teacher. But she would kind of sometimes even pound, "You must not go into a mess. Help someone or heal them or go to the hospital. If you're in the right nostril, you can be assured you will get sick." She said, "Stand outside that door and breathe in and out your right nostril. Don't take it in. You can't help someone taking it on like that." She would be very adamant about it. But likewise, if you have to go into a place where you have to be very energetic, if you're directing some activity, you know, in a school or a recreational facility, you can't be all, you know, like that. You have to be vibrant, radiant. You see what I'm saying? But also, if you're sitting in a class such as this, or you're wanting to be in a meditative state, perhaps one can think of being in that left nostril. Or one's looking for inspiration. Well, you don't do it by grabbing it. You know, you grab it by being receptive to it. So the left nostril, you see? Does that make sense?
So if you go in a situation, a hospital, like I remember you telling me you went to see, you know,
We were at the hospital all the time. You said, hold my left, hold your left nostril.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
But it's not, you're not being receptive to what's going on with your left.
Right. You're radiating. You can offer a radiance and a warmth to the situation, but not absorbing it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are beings that can do that. They transform it. They take it in and then they transform it. But perhaps we need to practice a bit before we take that on. Gain a little bit of mastery, because it can wear on someone. It can make you ill. It can hurt the nervous system and the physical body. And so this is the reason why we're doing these practices. Inshallah, God willing, we're learning something from it that's useful and applicable. Richard?
Mm-hmm. The thought occurred that this is where the notion of the unhealed healer comes from. People stepping in who are not prepared to. Stepping in before they're ready.
Well, also sometimes stepping in, you see, we can't say that perhaps that person needs to suffer in some way and to encounter that. You see, we can't say. You know, sometimes it's the difficulty that makes the body stronger to fight the infection, let's say, or the person that has to, instead of waiting, you know, for a handout, they have to go get the job or whatever. You see what I'm saying? That sometimes we can also, killing someone with kindness comes to mind.
But then the emphasis is sometimes on killing from an ego perspective.
For those that aren't here, Mary is smiling silently. You can draw your own conclusions. The silence is sometimes says everything. Yes?
I guess I've been pondering this the last few minutes, and I'll just ask it. There was a statement in something like creative thought cannot come from the left breath, but only from the right breath. I know I'm very aware when I'm in the left breath.
Yes.
And it's a very sweet kind of place.
Yes.
And it seems to me that I can be more receptive to my own imagination in that place, but I really have to sort of watch and see if that's true or not, I guess.
Right.
But in your experience as a creative artist, have you found that you can be in your left breath and still find great creativity bubbling up that's not coming from any outside thoughts but from your inner imagination?
Yeah, I find that I'm receptive when I'm in that left breath. I find also what I often rely on very much are the elemental breaths. If I'm seeking creativity, I will go to the air breath. Or I'll work my way up the elemental scale to the air breath. I will also, I will tell you how I use the air breath. I'm glad you brought this up, because to me they're really medicinal. For example, if someone says something to me that is hurtful or it, you know, penetrates in a way that has made an impression that I feel is not helpful to receive, some of them are, even if they are hurtful, but sometimes it's from someone else's projection, I will immediately go to the air breath to clear that away from my own mind. Do you understand? So these breaths are used in succession in contemplative work to study the effects of them when we're in a more quiet place. But when you need it, you know, sometimes if I'm at school and, you know, I teach for 6 hours straight. It's pretty rigorous. I'm on my feet, I'm interacting, I'm sort of moving quickly, moving from one student's, you know, issue to the next. They're problem solving. And so I have to quickly change gears. Sometimes I need the earth breath. If I'm in the air breath, it's not useful because I'm too, spacey. Sometimes to re-energize myself, I need the fire breath. So I'll take a small break, I'll go to the
ladies' room or my office, and I can do that fire breath, and I can re-energize myself, you see? Or if something's stuck, this is another way, like if a student's stuck on a problem, I can sometimes so clearly see the answer. Here again, if I give the answer, perhaps the student doesn't learn the lesson that they need to learn to get to their next step. What do? The water breath moves a stagnant situation, removes obstacles. You see, you really, if you study them, you use them when you need them in the moment. This is the point. Does that make sense?
Can you do the fire breath without the student knowing? Isn't that ujjayi, or you just...
That's a yogic practice. We can do these much more subtly.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you understand what I'm saying? And how applicable it is? Does that make sense to everyone?
This prompts another question.
Yeah.
You mentioned the circumstance in which you use the earth breath, stabilizing. I first learned these years ago, I think probably from Pierre Beloit, and I learned that earth breath originally is breathing up through the feet, breathing out of the feet, you know, that that approach. And I think that the times I've used the earth breath, that's sort of the method that I've tended to return to. But when you say you use the earth breath in these teaching situations, is it the one you've been teaching?
I go to the breath, a more assertive breath and the horizontal motion in the nose and out the nose.
We have a question. Go ahead, Amina. Turn on your microphone.
Okay, thank you. Which breath is best for gaining control of runaway thoughts?
Are we talking obsessive thought or creative thought?
Obsessive.
Does anyone want to take a guess at that based on even what... Or you, Amina, also think about what I've said just here in the last few minutes. What would you think that might... What might be the medicine for that? The antidote?
Yeah. Would it be air breath?
Air breath, if it's an obsessive thought that seems to be of a destructive nature, or a breath that you feel... not a breath, but a thought that you feel has been projected at you from another person. Or... unseen source, perhaps, could be environmental. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people pick up on things environmental. But if it's not that kind of thing, then what is the next breath you might go to? Anyone else?
Earth.
Grounding.
Right out of your head.
Yeah.
But if it has an emotive content, you might go to water.
You could go to water if it is of an emotional nature, because the water corresponds to the emotional body.
Okay, thank you.
So what it might be useful doing, again, getting back to how do we use these, Rashida Vira again had instructed me, and you can do this for oneself, you can do it for others. If someone has an actual physical disease, for example, I remember Rashida Vira had instructed me to, working with the elemental breaths, find at which, where on the elemental scale the disease originated. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because it's the most gross level is the physical level. But by that time, we don't know where it could have come from. We could be a thought, you know, the mental realm, the air breath. Oh, and then all of a sudden that tension manifests, comes down from the air thinking realm into the passion, the area of passion, which is fire, into the area of emotions, into the physical body, the earth. But it could have been an emotional wound. I think there's an uncanny link between women that have been abused or somehow had a bad relationship with a man that can end up with gynecological disease or breast cancer. There is an uncanny connection. Why is that? Do you see what I'm saying to you? So you have to really think about these things. And not only think about them, but almost... in a very objective way, Look at them. You see, these are lessons. We don't have to, I'm a victim, I'm a victim, I'm a victim, I did this, somebody did this, somebody did that, somebody did that. Okay, everyone's had their something. And some, most of us have had something really very quite dramatic, but is that how we wish to identify ourselves? Well, that's a pretty flimsy identity. But we can use these practices. And this is mysticism. Not hocus pocus, let's get our fancy shoes and fancy hats and fancy robes out, put some fancy beads around our neck and say we're mystics. No, that's not it at all. It's really using this knowledge in our everyday life. You see, the planet is in desperate need, and so is humanity. What do we think we're doing if we can't be of some benefit? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Seems like when I've noticed people who are depressed, or I've been depressed myself, just do the earth breath automatically, because it's kind of a retreat. You're not working it or breathing in any other way except slight in the nose and out the nose.
Well, one can also, when one is, one must observe the breath, because actually depression, you see, each one of these elements has its light side. So earth can offer stability and it can ground us. But my God, you know, sometimes it's like we're plodding through mud and what, you know, and it's, so it can make us, it can also get us very dogged. Stubborn people are very earth people. And when we ourselves become stubborn, we may be stuck in the earth. You see what I'm saying? Like quicksand. And then you say to yourself, oh my God, maybe I'm really stuck. You know, oh, and it can create depression. You see, that's the other side of the earth. And the water breath is progressive. But if someone's always like, oh, I'm on to the next step, I'm on to, you know, I can't ever manifest anything, well, then that's an imbalance. Or if someone's always crying at every little, you know, whatever. But something makes everybody, some people cry all the time. There's an imbalance in the water element. And someone's very, all the time, just, you know, sparking the fire element. But you can also really work with it. Sometimes you have to then become the handler of the fire or the handler of the water to understand it and balance it. But sometimes you need the antidote. Do you understand what I'm saying? So let's say if you're fiery and you need to balance it, which element would you pick to balance it with? Would you put air with it? Whoa! Really, right? And would you throw water on it? No, my gosh, no. That fire is going to really react if it feels like it's going to get thrown water. But what can you use? Earth, you see what I'm saying? Okay. And if you're really dogged and stuff, then what are you going to use? You going to use water?
Fire.
You guys are brilliant students. This is the brilliance of the teacher. You're not going to throw water on it. You're going to get mud, quicksand. Do you see? It's actually very common sense. It's not a mystery at all, if you think about it. I was on the Skype yesterday with Piramushita Diet, and I said, we have to demystify mysticism. If we don't demystify it, what use is it to humanity? We can't keep all of this secret, like we, you know, going to have our secret, you know, handshakes or whatever. I mean, what is that? What use is it, you know? Even the language also must be, in my opinion, you know this, many of you, thank you very much, that, you know, all of this speaking in these foreign languages, it's interesting. Of course, it has a vibration, but then, well, what does it really mean? I mean, there are many people here that come, if I start starting with this blah, 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 in another language, they're going to get up and think, oh my God, these people are like a cult. I better get out of here and run away from them. So we have to think about how can we make this accessible to everyone. You can see that it's logical, a logical methodology, you might say.
It seems like, though it is a little open to interpretation,
everything is, isn't it?
Of which breath you would use, because it seems like it could change depending on who's looking at.
But the most important thing is who you looking at it yourself, you see.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, like, there's no right answer.
No. And in different situations, it would be an absolutely different answer. I mean, I was giving examples, but we could give others as well. Yeah, absolutely. It's an alive. It's these elements are alive. They are all around us.
Well, and so that's the theory of relativity, though,
mm-hmm.
what we were talking about earlier with string theory and vibration.
Megan?
Mm-hmm. I was just, like you were saying, just, of course, the importance of trusting our intuition also in terms of the one that we need in that moment.
I guess nothing is ever pure. You're never being pure earth. There's always some mixture.
Absolutely.
So some other mixture would be the counter or to help it. It needs some consideration.
Well, and I think the ideal is for us, that's why we're doing the practice, is to sort of balance all of those, you know. Do you know what I mean? When we do the elemental breaths, we're trying to find sort of that balance and alignment with all of them. But then also understanding them in their individual way, how do we invoke them when we need them, right? Does that make sense? This is why retreat is very good, because then we can really, those of you that haven't done individual retreats might consider that at some point, because one can really explore in a safe environment the effects of these and go deeply into it without the influence. You know, this is the benefit of silent, reclusive retreat, is we're so easily pulled from, you know, someone compliments us, oh, you know, or someone says something, you know, or, oh, I gotta go speak to that person, or, oh, I better hide from that person, whatever that is. You know what I mean? It's like, there's so much stimulation around us, right? Thank God for caller ID. Any other comments or questions? I'm checking the time because I know we have quite a whole into the night. Some of us are continuing with other practices elsewhere, and everyone is certainly welcome. There's another community activity at St. Mary's Church at 13th and Holmes at 8 o'clock tonight. It's a celebration, just for those that don't know, the celebration of the great mystic poet of Persia, which is now known as the part that has become Turkey, Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi. Great scholar. He was an advocate, an attorney, when he met his teacher was a wanderer and kind of appeared on the scene. And in that day, you know, books were so precious, not everyone had them, only the very learned. And I've heard it said that Shams of Tabriz took the books from Rumi and threw them in a well. And Rumi was looked at the precious books. And when he looked up, he saw the face of Shams, and it was like looking into the sun, and his limited self was shattered. And they spent long times in spiritual discourse as a student and teacher. And it is said that Shams left and Rumi fell into despair, and then Shams appeared again, and, you know, he felt whole, and then Shams disappeared again. There's some thought about his demise, so to speak, which had to do with the students of Jalaluddin Rumi and people near him becoming very jealous of that relationship. And it is thought that perhaps
Shamsa Tabriz came to an untimely demise at the hands of jealous friends. And this is then, they say, really why the turn. You see, if you've ever seen an animal that's in great despair, what do?
Hibernate.
They walk in a circle. They walk in a circle. They walk in a circle. Caged animals, you see it, there's a path. And this is what Rumi did. In his despair, he began to turn. Not everyone knows this story. And he turned and he turned and he turned. Children do that too sometimes, for joy, but also if they're in despair. He turned and he turned. And then what arose out of that, like a vortex, was this incredible poetry, ecstatic poetry. But it was out of despair.
Does he turn clockwise or counterclockwise?
Counterclockwise.
Okay, thank you.
I'm thinking since the beginning when you said that phrase, breaking ourselves on God, that's just stuck with me all afternoon, thinking about it, and I'm kind of talking about, you know, when our heart breaks, that it's open, that it opens.
Yes.
And it's like just been theme that's been going through.
Yeah.
Anything else that you've been saying, and when you were talking about sometimes you need to suffer, you need to be broken for some reason.
It's, and when we are broken open, we become bigger than who we thought we were. Mm-hmm. The container, you know, I love the, if you, you know, I was in graduate school, one of the things we had to do is we didn't have to, but I did. I worked with the science museum. And so I was developing content and exhibition for children to learn about animals and scientific principles. And one of the things, a display that I worked on was about crabs. Not the kind you get from sexual encounters, but I am always so bad.
Just part of life.
But you know, it is. It's true. And I myself have had them more than once in head lice from being in India, believe me. And it wasn't from sexual encounters, it was some other things. But at any rate, I mean, it's just part of it. It's like, you know, I feel bad about killing him, but, you know, I did, so you don't have to worry about hugging me. So, but at any rate. So the point is that the crab, in order for it to grow, it has to crack its shell open. And then it's like this fleshy mass, you know, and it crawls out, mm-hmm. and it sits behind that shell, which is really interesting, because in a way, that's what we do, and, you know, it's like posturing itself, so this shell that it's out of, and just this fleshy mass, is protecting it, and then slowly it grows its little paper back and tin back, and then it becomes the hardback shell again, but it's a very interesting metaphor, isn't it? And the snake shedding its skin. I mean, mm-hmm. how can it grow unless it does that? Mm-hmm. You see? Nature is so extraordinary because if we pay attention, it's telling us everything. And we're part of nature. We sometimes forget that. Yes. Other comments or questions? It certainly leads to lively, or if someone can elaborate on the points that I myself have made, if you'd like.
Crabs also move like this on the beach.
Sideways.
They move clockwise, going like this on the beach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When they move in circles. Mm-hmm.
Shall I continue the rest of this reading?
Please.
So I'll just go back to the beginning of this paragraph, and there are two more here. Every person has either a Jalal temperament or a Jamal temperament. A person with temper is Jalal, with courage is Jalal, with power, with strength is Jalal. A person with kindness, tolerance, forgiveness,
meekness, mildness, modesty, humility, is all of the Jamal temperament. Then, through the day and night, man changes his condition from Jalal to Jamal, and from Jamal to Jalal, either owing to the influence of his breath, or controlled by the breath of another, or a situation makes him be in Jalal or Jamal, or his own thought, speech, or action. In war, the offense is Jalal, the defense is Jamal. In trade, the purchaser is Jalal, the seller is Jamal. On the stage, the performer is Jalal, and the audience is Jamal. Jalal has a tendency to be active, and sometimes it acts beyond control. Therefore, in the capacity of Jalal, a greater control is needed than in Jamal. With power comes great responsibility.
I'm confused about
the trader and the seller.
Yeah, I
everything else made perfect sense.
Yeah, I think so too. And I'm sometimes wondering if this isn't, I should check back to the source, because it also didn't sound right. But let me just think about it for a moment to see if it makes sense.
Is it cultural?
In the trade, the purchaser
we're in a different
Jalal.
Kind of market than...
Yeah, you know, I think it's true because here we're given the price.
Mm-hmm.
And there we have to be much more... You know, when I'm in India, someone gives me a price, I cut it by four. And then I start bargaining from there, which would put me in a more aggressive Jalal, you know. And and then walking away, you know, I would know then. And then, you know, I'm sort of in that position of power.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, was, you know... cultured in that environment.
I think even here, United States.
Think of eBay.
Yes, it's
true. The buyer is actively seeking to purchase something.
Yeah, that's true.
And
that's a good point.
They're making the bids. The seller is simply putting a picture and a description up on the website and waiting for the bidding cycle, the auction to end.
That's a good example.
Well, and the thought of supply and demand.
Yes, that's right.
Supply is demand.
There you go. So now we're glad you brought it up. That's clear now, isn't it?
I guess it's true. I think the primary mode of commerce in the U.S. is probably oligopolistic, where the seller is taking a very activist stance toward developing, creating the market into which they're selling.
Yeah.
It really depends on the question. Well, I mean, I don't want to put economics, but
yeah.
I mean, you know.
Well, our culture teaches us to be lazy and be told what we need to buy.
But now it's the consumer that's taking the power and inventing things like eBay and
it's
trading
true.
Lists and getting rid of the seller completely and just turning into a trade commerce.
So it's when we look at it, that's why I wanted to really look at it deeper. So Jalal has a tendency to be active, and sometimes it acts beyond control. Therefore, in the capacity of Jalal, a greater control is needed than in Jamal. For everything that runs quickly is in danger of falling. Among Sufis, there are two kinds of adepts, the Jalali and the Jamali, and each has its own line of progress and action. They are not called so for their temperament, but for their method of progress and action. You see the difference there. They are not called so for their temperament, but for their method of progress and action. The Jalali among them, with their great psychic power, can prophesize and cast out devils and heal and control the world and heavens according to their development. They are most likely among dervishes, fakirs, and sometimes they are called rhine. When they are under guise which deludes the pious, keeping them from going near them. Jamali are the ones who are with God throughout the day and night, who love and repent and bless and serve and glorify the name of their Lord and guide their followers through all difficulties in the spiritual path and draw people to God from the struggles of life. Their way is that of the saints in the past. It's a beautiful teaching, isn't it?
I was thinking of St. Teresa, especially the little flower, and Mother Teresa also, the people who serve. What immediately came to mind with that description.
Well, something they said the psychic was the Jalal.
Mm-hmm.
Psychic powers. Where I would have maybe thought it was Jamal, but maybe Jamal's more intuitive.
Yeah.
We had the good fortune of having Comto Rinpoche visit us about a month ago, and he was here in our home for about 7 days, 8 days. And he's a great saint amongst his people. He served as the Minister of Culture and Religion and, served as a doctor. He's a mathematician and established a small monastery. Now he's been asked by the Dalai Lama to establish yet another larger one, and which is still very modest compared to the great monasteries. He's been a great servant to his people and very close. He's actually the tantric master to the Dalai Lama and high-ranking public official, but really such a gentle person at the same time. But he said to us that he felt, we were talking, I have this little book about the saints, and it was All Saints Day when he was here. And so we were talking about that, and he said to us, I believe that the Christian saints were the greatest servers of humanity. They were real bodhisattvas. And I've recently picked up the autobiography of, because I've read this, the Little Flower story, the story of my soul, a couple times. I'm very close to her. Some of you know that. But Saint Bernadette also I have an affinity towards. And I love the story because when she had her first apparition, it was indicated by a gust of wind. And then her attention was drawn and she saw the first appearance of the Virgin to her, a lady dressed in white with a rosary draped over her arm. And it is said that she wasn't able to move. She was really transfixed, and she wanted to raise her hand to make the sign of the cross, and she couldn't do it until the Virgin herself lifted the hand, and then she was in harmony with that motion. But I love this story. And it has to do with suffering, because her story is a beautiful story, if you know it. But I'll just tell you the first part. So after the first, she was with her sister and a friend gathering firewood and bones, that said. I guess they sold the bones for, I don't know what they used them for, to tell you the truth. I haven't gotten that far in that story. If any of you know, you can tell me later. But at any rate, her sister, when they came upon her, knew she was out. The vision had disappeared by this time, but they could tell she was apparently quite frail and sensitive to the cold, and she didn't appear to be at all touched by the elements. She was warm and all aglow, and so her sister knew something had happened. It was her younger sister, and she said, "Just tell me what has happened." She just wanted to be silent. She just thought, "I can't say." Well, her sister kept coaxing her. And then, what did her sister do? She picked up a piece of wood and started beating her. And then, if that weren't enough, she went and she had promised she would not tell a soul what Bernadette had told her. Well, what did she do? She ran immediately home, told the mother, and then the mother beat Bernadette again. So there you go.
I love that story. When you said coaxing, I thought that was a very kind word.
Yes, that's right.
I think it would have been pestering.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
More like it.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a good story and to remember sometimes. Yeah. Even the saints get their bashing, you know.
Or usually.
Yeah, usually. And that's what contributes to the sainthood. Isn't it true? Well, I think I have done enough. Do you feel you've had your fill?
Thank you.
And as I said, we have some, I think, warm tea. I forgot to turn it on. It was warm before you came. It's been cooling now. So we'll try to fire that up. And we have some bottled water and some light snacks for you. I always say the teachings are for free. My time is service to you. I expect nothing. We do have several, the center has several things on its agenda that's calling for financial support. So I know some of us are going out to dinner. One might think about eating lighter and offering a little more to the basket. And if you have a little bit that you can share with us, we'll certainly put it to good use. And we know that these kinds of things, these are the first principles of all the great faiths, love and charity, and certainly in Buddhism, the first of the great perfections is generosity. So if you can offer something not, then we would so happy to receive your prayers for our ongoing movement. And if we could rise and hold hands, please. O Thou, who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear Thy voice, which constantly cometh from within. Disclose to us Thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us Thy great goodness. Teach us Thy loving forgiveness. Raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide. Send us the peace of Thy divine Spirit, and unite us all in Thy perfect being. Whatever benefit there may have arisen from this practice and our time together, for the benefit of all beings.